Chapter 57 Pitt, Steiger, and Admiral Sandecker stood around a drafting table in Pitt's hangar at the Washington National Airport and examined a large-scale map of the area's waterways. Fox did a radical facelift on the Iowa for a damned good reason, Pitt was saying. 16 feet. That's how much he raised her waterline.
You certain you have an accurate figure? Sandecker asked. That leaves a draft of only 22 feet.
He shook his head. It doesn't seem credible.
I got it from a man who should know, answered Pitt. While Dale Jarvis was on the phone to NSA headquarters, I questioned Metz, the shipyard boss. He swore to the measurements.
But for what purpose? Said Steiger.
By removing all the guns and replacing them with wooden dummies, the ship is totally useless.
Number 2 turret and all its fire control equipment is still in place, Pitt said. According to Metz, the Iowa can lob a salvo of 2,000-pound shells 20 miles into a rain barrel.
Sandecker concentrated his attention on lighting a large cigar.
Satisfied that it was properly stoked, he blew a cloud of blue smoke at the ceiling and rapped the map with his knuckles.
Your plan is crazy, Dirk. We're meddling in a conflict way over our heads.
We can't sit here and piss and moan, said Pitt. The President will be persuaded by the Pentagon strategists either to blow the Iowa out of the water, more likely than not spreading the QD to the winds, or to send out a boarding party to capture the gas shells, with the idea of incorporating them into the Army's arsenal.
But what good is a plague organism that can't be controlled? Asked Steiger.
You can bet every biologist in the country will be funded to search for an antidote, Pitt replied. If one makes a breakthrough, then someday, somewhere, a general or an admiral may panic and give the order for its dispersal.
Me, I don't want to grow old, knowing I had an opportunity to save countless lives but failed to act.
Pretty speech, said Sandecker. I'm in total agreement, but the three of us are hardly in a position to compete with the Defense Department in a race to recover the 2 remaining QD warheads.
If we could sneak a man on board the Iowa first, a man who could disarm the firing mechanism of the projectiles and dump the organism pellets over the side into the water,
Pitt let his thought linger.
And you are that man, ventured Sandecker.
Of us three, I'm the best qualified.
Aren't you forgetting me, mister? Steiger said acidly.
If all else fails, we'll need a good man at the controls of the helicopter.
Sorry, Abe, but I can't fly one, so you're elected.
Since you put it that way, replied Steiger with a wry smile, how can I refuse?
The trick is to ferret out the Iowa before the boys at defense, said Sandecker.
Not a likely event, since they have the advantage of satellite reconnaissance.
What if we know exactly where the Iowa is headed, Pitt said, grinning.
How? Grunted a skeptical Steiger.
The draft was the giveaway, answered Pitt.
There's only one waterway within Fox's steaming distance that would require a draft of no more than 22 feet.
Sandecker and Steiger stood silent and expressionless, waiting for Pitt to unravel the knot.
The capital, Pitt said with a certain finality.
Fox is going to run the Iowa up the Potomac River and hit Washington.
Fox's arms ached, and the sweat of intense concentration rolled down his weathered face and trickled into his beard. But for his arm movements, he might have been cast in bronze. He was desperately tired. He had stood at the helm of the Iowa for nearly 10 hours, resting the mighty ship through channels she was never designed to enter. The palms of his hands were seeded with broken blisters, but he did not care. He was in the home stretch of his impossible journey. The long, lethal guns of Number 2 turret were already within range of Pennsylvania Avenue. He called for flank speed on the telegraph, and the vibration from deep below decks increased. Like an old warhorse at the sound of the bugle, the Iowa dug her screws into the muddy river and charged up the narrows beside Cornwallis Neck on the Maryland bank. The Iowa looked like something not of this world. Rather, it looked like a mammoth, smoke-breathing monster erupting from the depths of hell. She forged ahead faster, sweeping past the channel buoys that fell back toward the first tendrils of dawn. It was as if she had a heart and soul and somehow knew this was her final voyage, knew she was about to die,
the last of the fighting battleships. Fox stared in fascination at the glow from the lights of Washington looming 20 miles ahead. The Marine base at Quantico fell behind the stern as the Iowa's irresistible mass hurtled around Hallowing Point and sped past Gunston Cove. Only one bend remained before her bows entered the straight channel ending on the edge of the golf course at East Potomac Park. 23 feet, the depth reader's voice droned over the speaker. 23. 22.5. The ship dashed by the next channel buoy, her 18-foot, 5-bladed outboard propellers flailing at the bottom silt, her bow throwing sheets of white foam as she plowed against the 5-knot current. 22 feet, Captain. The voice had a tone of urgency. 22 holding. Holding. Oh, God, 21.5. Then she struck the rising riverbed like a hammer into a pillow. The impact seemed a sensation more known than felt as the bows bored into the mud. The engines continued to hum and the screws went on thrashing, but the Iowa lay still. She had come to rest below the sloping grounds of Mount Vernon.